it is, you just read through that, go back to footnotes, just read, get the, and that is very easy, that's very light, and take one of each. Just read the article, it's about 15 pages of the, and it's interesting reading, okay? Then, what I suggest you do is to read it a second time, and then read it with the footnotes. Okay, reading with the footnotes, there is the footnote, there are two types of footnotes. There's footnotes that are just like, I can't convince you with logic, I'll give you 10,000 McCulloughs. You know, it's that type of footnotes. Which we call the issue of the keys. Just try to floor the other guy, just throw anything you ever heard, never knew, ever across all the cross references. Some of them are more discussive. First of all, I talk about Will Reedy McGilla in the footnote. When I go into a lot of the issues that we talked about, the Carbon Asana, the Carbon Atana we talked about the Magen Avraham, a lot of that stuff, since it's not the thrust, one of each, please. Since it's not the thrust of that particular the paper in this format, part two, I'll talk about. See, part one talks about women's prayer groups and the things I covered in theory. Can you do it? Should you do it? The second part of the paper will be, assuming that you can do it, how to do it. Okay? That's the second part. There I deal with, if you're going to do a Megillah reading, how to do it, what brachot to make, use a rubber band, do women count from yin, count from yin, don't count from yin, and I talk about women's prayer groups and how can it be done, what should be done, what can't be done, assuming that it's not. The location, should women and women's prayer group cover their hair, should they cover their hair? Should they, what do have they done? All sorts of questions, that's dealt with part two of the paper, which you don't have. exactly what my students say. Okay, so there's a lot of very fascinating stuff in the footnotes, historical documentation, which, as you read through it, you can see what type of footnotes you want to read, and what you don't read. Then there's a section at the end of the paper, in between the paper and the footnotes, called the addenda. The addenda are essentially five mini papers dealing with the whole question of lying. There's one paper on lying, one paper on misrepresentation, one paper on calling something to the right when it's only for a bono. That deals with the different major topics that we don't, that are sort of we wanted to discuss, but and are extremely relevant to the paper. But in order to make it more readable, we just put them in this five mini papers. And I'm proud to say you have before you 114 pages, so obviously you were doing something right. Okay, that's this, and you can judge whether. I've received a lot of comments back on the paper already. I got a lot of comments back, and the nicest comments that we've had is that we really don't know how you hold on the issue, which is very good. I mean, the paper comes off as really very objective, and which we worked very hard on. Actually, see, I was being four points per, which I don't be using against. It was the best way to resolve the discrepancy. Anyway. Now, this paper is, I gave you six months ago, a different paper. I gave you a paper that looked like this, okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That came out in April of 1997, and I printed it for you. Take one of each, please. April 1997, and that was published after the first Women and Feminism Conference, and it was a report that appeared in the Jewish Observer, then in 1997. And this appears after the second second conference, which occurred just recently, and it's the tone is essentially along the same lines. The critique is very interesting. The presentation is quite unfair, but. But it has an axe to grind. And again, I told you that maybe what I hope we'll do is sometime when we start reconvene again, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about all these papers together. That's this paper, and it's for your reading pleasure. This is a appeared in the same issue that the article appeared in. There was a discussion on Shalom Sani Isha. It was a very interesting give and take between Joel Wolowski and Emmanuel Feldman about the propriety of saying Shalom Sani Isha. And Joel Wolowski was of the opinion, I don't want to go through the whole paper, but Joel Wolowski in that discussion was of the opinion that since it's misunderstood, widely misunderstood the bracha, then men shouldn't say it, at least they shouldn't say it out loud. Not to be offensive. And Emmanuel Feldman says, if people are misunderstanding, why should I re-educate them? Why should I? I'm just telling you what there was a discussion in tradition about the bracha Shalom Sani Isha. I'm giving you the gist of the arguments in both directions. In response,
I didn't get the Shalom Sani Isha.
Shalom Sani Isha.
I didn't get the gist of it.
Oh, I said Joel Wolowski was of the opinion that Shalom Sani Isha in shuls should not be said out loud. Men go up, they say the bracha out loud. What are the bracha they say? Shalom Sani Isha. He was of the opinion that they shouldn't say it because there are women in the community who misunderstand the bracha, view it as they're offensive to them, and therefore men shouldn't say it out loud. There's no
out loud.
Most
women aren't sure what that's like. Most men aren't here.
Daniel Feldman was the opinion. He says that because women, there are people who prefer to misunderstand it. I should say, it's not prefer to misunderstand it. The truth of the matter is that Joel demonstrates, and correctly so, that there are trends in the commentaries on the bracha that do learn it as a male chauvinistic bracha. Others, as I try to present, clearly say not so. And from the 1700s on, there's a clear split in the Muslim.
A lot of people take exception.
A lot of people take exception. So Joel's opinion, you don't have to, no, shouldn't say it out loud. Emmanuel Feldman says, why did people misunderstand the bracha, take exception to it? That's not a problem. It's not meant in the modern period. We don't mean it that way, or shouldn't mean it that way, etc., etc. But that's what the discussion was about. In any case, in response, a very well-known scholar by the name of Menachem Kellner wrote an article which deals with a letter to the editor on the issue of militant feminism, about changing halakha, or changing what is considered acceptable practice by doing it, even though it's not acceptable. But let's put it this way. It's a case of where the halacha permits it, but the community does not normally do it. And Menachem Kellner says he took the stance encouraging women to do things which halacha permits, but common normative practice, including not that way, to go ahead and essentially try to change what's normative in halacha by crashing the barriers. And Emmanuel Feldman argues against it. It's militant feminism versus normative halacha position. So very interesting give and take. And when we discuss feminism, many of the issues raised in this letter by Keller versus Feldman is this actually echoed in this article on the women's feminism. The issue is not a trivial issue. The issue is that there is a clear, from the conference, there was a clear, well, I guess the militants in the conference were clearly women who, though committed to halacha, were committed to only what's on the books. Anything that's on the books says that the halacha required. Anything that the rabbis might forbid because of public policy, they were not willing to follow. And there's a whole discussion about it. You can read it, you make your own judgments, and we'll discuss it at great length. Okay, that's the way of introduction. You have, I trust you have enough to spend the summer reading. Okay. Tonight we're going to start a discussion which deals with women in public roles. There is one major issue which we will assume, and not go into it at great length, and that has to do with women serving as judges under a Jewish court, or women serving as witnesses. On that issue, we will assume for argument's sake, okay, not in practice, because there are a lot of, the way the Jewish courts function nowadays is very different, but that's not the issue I want to deal with, although it's clearly related. We're going to start off, and I'll we did discuss it. But the issue we're going to start off from, the premise we're going to start off with is that women do not serve as judges on Jewish courts, nor do they serve as witnesses, aiding in those things that involve establishing, how should I put it, establishing ritual matters, okay? Like for gittin and for kiddushin and those things that establish ritual matters. Women do testify in Jewish courts, even though as in, on the books women don't testify and not accept as witnesses, but they do appear on a regular basis in Jewish courts as what's called shuda d'dayna, that is, a woman comes to court and says, I saw it happen. And the judge says, I believe it. And then the judge is a participant in the evaluation. It doesn't go just by witnesses. Two witnesses come to court, a judge can say, my head feeling tells me that he's lying. And the judge has the right not to accept the witness, even if it's valid witness. It's called shuda d'dayna. The judge has a right to evaluate the validity of a judge. And I don't want to go into that particular issue. Okay, so we're going to leave the question of witnesses. We're going to witnesses and judges on the side, assuming that for argument's sake, okay, it's just that there's a beginning, the basic halacha, the women do not serve as judges and or as witnesses in the Jewish court.
So you said that the judge has a right to not receive
the
witness, that pertains to men as well? Oh, okay.
And then you can believe people, like a woman comes and says, testifies about something, and the judge says, no, she's telling the truth, I accept it. But it's a whole different, I'm not an expert in that. This is one of the things I want to learn over the summer. So I don't want to go into the exact details.
I have never been tempted in a vestibule or anything like that. But do people, men or women, who are going to give testimony?
Sure.
Do swear? No.
There are certain times that they're given oaths, but they don't swear before they come to a court.
No.
The assumption is. No, when a person comes to give testimony, he gives testimony. Yes, he has what's called chesed kashrut, unless you know that something's wrong with him, you believe a Jew comes to court and testifies. They don't swear in the Bible in that sense.
Except for
Cater
against another.
No, there's certain cases where you make a person swear in the sacred Torah, and there's a whole text there about how he does a bad smoke. But make certain cases. Not normal.
In cases of a
Buddha,
we have two more. One Buddha considered this.
No question. Okay, but since I really haven't mastered that area yet, I don't feel comfortable talking. Okay, but the premise in all the discussion, as you're going to see, is that acceptance that normatively women do not serve as judges. And we'll see that the decision between that and woman's being passed in childless is they matter. Please take one. Okay. Now, I think the important, let's begin our discussion by pointing out that throughout Jewish history, as a general rule, we don't find women in long-term leadership roles until the modern period. With the exception of really two personalities. One was Dvorah. Anybody know who the second one is? That's a good point. We don't see her in leadership. They came to her as a Nevi'ah. It's leadership role. We don't find she was a king. Shlomo Tzion HaMalka. She was queen, right, for a very long period. And she was on great terms with the Chachamim. The Chachamim loved her. She was a firm woman. This was in the Roman period, but the Shlomo Tzion HaMalka was after Yanai. It's after, in the wane of the Hashmonaic period, just before the...
What did she get to the family?
She's married into the family.
But
she was the wife of Yanai and Melech. I'm getting cousins. What? She got from her father? No, she didn't think she was...
Something.
Okay. I feel terrible because I'm just reading it. Okay. Anywho, so we know that Dvorah HaNeviah, it says by her Dvorah Ish HaNeviah, he shofetet in Yisrael Beit Ahi. She was a judge. This wasn't just the prophetess. She was the people followed her. followed her into war, followed her to battle. Now, the role of Shafetet, because it appears in Sefer Shoftim, was a combination of judge and leader, and clearly presented the posting with a variety of problems. First of all, how is she Shofetet? So she Shofetet, and the premise we had a discussion is that women can be judges. And the other question is, how did she serve as a leader? Which is a point that we'll get back to again. Now, we'll return to this question, because that's going to be the jumping point for our discussion. But I want to give a little bit of history. And I want to, let's jump into the 1900s, because in the modern period, I mean, the truth of the matter is the issue of women in leadership roles wasn't a major issue, because it wasn't true in world history. You rarely had, you did have a few women serving, you didn't have that many women. How many women leaders you know in world history? So if I said,
Victoria.
Right, that's right, that's more than my day. But you can name them, you can name them all. Catherine the Great, and you can name Cleopatra, but you can name them all. While if I ask you to name all the male leaders, you go on for a while if you can name them. The fact of the matter is that as a general rule, it's true, there are a few women who are clearly well-known leaders in the Jewish world, but in the secular world as well, there weren't that many, it was really quite rare until the modern period. It was only after World War One that women began getting the rights to vote and to be elected to public office. In 1917, women got the right to vote in Russia. In 1918, in England. In 1919, in Germany. And the US and Canada in 1920. That's the end of the 1920. In France, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité. Women got the right, didn't get the right to vote until the close of the World War II. That's in 1944, and enlightened Switzerland, 1971. Okay, now in response to literature, the issue comes up, the whole idea of voting. Okay, now that's a very democratic concept. But there is a concept of voting, you know, in the Vadot here, we have to decide on taxation, who's going to be the leadership of the community. In many ways, Judaism was a theocracy, but it was also very democratic. There were rules of how you vote, how you vote by income, by your land, by how much you're taxed, by one man, one vote, different issues. But in the response to literature, the whole question of voting and running for public office heated up in the period of 1918 to 1920. Because following World War I, Palestine became a mandate of the British man, of the British Commonwealth, the British mandate. And it prepares itself for the implementation of the Balfour Declaration, and the whole question of suffrage. I mean, the whole world was given the women's right to vote, why not in Palestine as well? And there ensued, as a result, an impassioned polemic in which the leading postmen of Israel, Europe, and America espoused differing views on this issue. So that's the first time, if you look in the halakhic literature, in the period of the 1918, remember, I told you that the rest of the world, the women's getting suffrage is 1917, 1918, 1920. So in this period, 1918 to 1920, is where there are hundreds of chumos being written in Eretz Israel and Europe on this issue of women's right to vote or for public office.
And the first votes for the first election, in the issue, the mandate. I know there's a big thing about women voting and they have...
I'll come back to it in a second, okay? In fact, that's where the Edith already started. It's over the women's issue. I'll talk about it. I'll come back to it in a second. The next time they heated it up was in the early 1970s when women's lib began to have its impact on the Orthodox Jewish community and the major issue. Do you remember what the major issue was at that time in the 1970s? Women sitting on synagogue boards, where women could be presidents of shuls. That was the major issue in 1970. 1950, by the way, before that, the major issue was mechitzas. That was the whole period of the 1950s. And that, by the 1950s, was when the conservative movement formally split off the Orthodox movement, and it split off over the women's issue. I will argue that the most major splits in the modern period, right, in the 50s. All the major chumas, all of, in the major period, all the major splits in Kleisha occurred around women. I mean it very seriously. In the 1950s, it was over the Bechitz issue. In the 1970s, no question about it. Sitting in the Rabbi Shaktiel, sitting on the religious councils, and that was the next question, the whole issue of women in public leadership. And, okay.
Was Shaktiel an argument
in
the last
days? Shaktiel, I correspond with her regularly.
No, what I'm saying is, and as people came out against this, I never heard any particular cultural arguments against it.
Oh, there were some. There were. Let's put it this way. What's amazing is these same gentlemen sat with women and all sorts of, I'm just saying, on the Iriot, and then that didn't bother them. There was something special about the religious councils, which was, to some extent, they felt it was a hate, we'll talk about this. And it was a very hot political issue. There was a lot more. We read a tshuva from a Sholi Israeli, an unpublished tshuva, which he wrote me on this issue. And you'll see what his argument. We'll read it together. Okay, let's begin the discussion with the sources. Okay, sources begin, source number one, in Shoftim. The pasuk says, okay, source number one. Ki tavo el ha'aretz asher Hashem elokecha noten lach v'yirishtah v'yishtah. When you come to the land and you conquer it and dwell within it. V'amata, as you say, asim alay v'alach, I'll place upon me a king. V'chol ha'goyim asher zir surah. I want to put a king like all the nations around me. So to Simalechem, indeed, place upon yourself a king. Asher yivchar Hashem v'kecham tov, which God picks. Interesting, that's Jewish idea, democracy. You pick whoever God says. So there's a very interesting interaction. Mikevet achecha to Simalechem. From amongst your brothers, you will put upon yourself a king. Lo tuchal latek alecha ish nachri asher lo achichu. You're not allowed. It says, doesn't say you're not allowed. You cannot. You don't have the power. Very strong language. It means even if you do it, it's ineffectual. Lo tuchal nasim alecha ish nachri asher lo achichu. You cannot put upon yourself a non-Jew, or it says ish nachri, a stranger who is not your brother. I hope you already feel there's a tremendous amount of evidence. So as the halacha says, come back to it. Just keep your ears open. It says, tosam yalecha melech three times, and it says, you can't put on somebody who's non-Jew who's not your brother. I mean, obviously, if he's non-Jew, he's not your brother. It's just tremendous amount of redundancy here. And for halacha says, who counts every word, this means something. It's coming to teach us that halacha. Okay. Now, in addition to the requirement that you have to put upon yourself a king, there's an additional requirement about the king. Rak lo yelbelo sisim, who's not allowed on horses. I mean, a rich person can get as many horses as he wants to. But a king can't. He's limited. Back when you have a susim, remember susim was considered, you know, to the somewhat, you know, susim to the I guess in that period was with cars of the Saudis, right? Lo yavelach susim v'lo yeshiva ta'am Mitzrayim. He can't go back to Mitzrayim. The ma'avosos, because the susim were common in Egypt. V'Hashem amar lachem lo tosifu lashu b'derech hazeot. God doesn't want you to go back to Mitzchah. V'lo yavbelo nashim, you shouldn't have too many wives. An ordinary guy can have as many wives as he wants to. King cannot have a lot of wives. Halacha says he can have his 18. V'lo yavbelo nashim, v'lo yasur l'bavo, because he shouldn't turn his day, and his heart should not return. The kesef v'zahav lo yarbel amo. He can't be fabulously wealthy. And you can, an ordinary person can be fabulously wealthy, but a king can't. Right? The money that the kings had, you look into Tanakh, the money that the kings had were where? It was the wealth of the country. It was the wealth of the Mikdash. Every time, you know, some of these guys came in from from Syria, from every time they started coming, running across Israel, they emptied out the gold that was in the Beit HaMikdash. The king of Saba did not have that much money. Now, clearly Shlomo HaMelech was problematic in all three camps. Wives, horses, money. Right? And Shlomo was a problem. He was really a problem. And furthermore, the king has to know that he's subservient to a divine constitution. He's a constitutional monarch. He should write this sefer, sefer dvarim, al sefer on a book, and it's with him, the karabo koyim nechayah, and he reads about, he should read from it all the days of his life. Laman yilmod liyirat Hashem lekav, you should know to fear God, lishmor kedevet of azot, and keep all the words of the Torah, v'techukim ha'ilah, and these rules, lasotam. Levotirum levavom lechav, you shouldn't be haughty and raise himself above. He's got to know that his power comes from God and from the people, and that he should not be haughty above the people. Ulevitir sum min ha'mitzvah yaminu smol, you should not turn right or left from the Torah. So therefore he will, his kingdom will be long in days, years. He and his sons became Israel, amongst Israel. Now, that's the text. Now let's not go back over the text, but read it the way I try to just see what the redundancies are and how the halacha now analyzes this particular section. Okay, let's start from the beginning. Kitavala, the Shah Hashem, the Kerala Telecha, the Mishnah, the Shah Tabar, the Shah, it's okay. Vamatan, you say, Vasima alai melech, kechol asher goyim asher yisrael. I want to put a king like everybody else is. Okay. So, to see alecha melech. Okay, there's the first redundancy. Right? First one, just what? Yes, we read them for shingles. That's not tonight's discussion. Right. That is, you're 100% right. In fact, Shmuel and Navi, right? Shmuel and Navi, when the people come and ask for a king, he lays into that. And then all they said was, give us a king, like the Torah says, give us a king the way the people, you know, the way the other nations have. Now, and so all the Mephoshim said, what if? That's what he did. Look at Shmuel, and look at the Mephoshim and Shmuel. They're trying to understand Shmuel's rage, and the Mephoshim here, and the Mephoshim here, and the Mephoshim and Shmuel, and they will supplement each other how to understand the pasuk. How to understand these pasuk. Clearly, the pasuk could mean this is what you're going to do when I'm not happy. Because if you really trust in God, that would be your motivation. There's a problem because somebody ten night hold it's a mitzvah to put on yourself a king. The Rambam counts a mitzvah to put on a king. So, one way of learning it, just to answer your question, is even if you're going to want to do it like all the nations, I tell you, this is how you're going to do it. There are some psukim in the Torah where the Likras presented as my brother Dov, who's as a legal expert, points out, he says, Kamasim Mitzrayim lo tasu, u'chutei lo tereh. What's this? What is the Torah worried about? What's this masa mitzrayim? Or what is this? There seems to be, you know, in every legal system, there are the laws, and then there's the normative practice of the people. Now, there are a lot of gray areas of law, and then when you come before a court, the court has certain precedent that it picks up, that it uses to interpret the law. The Torah was very concerned that the Jews would fall back on Egyptian practice of how to interpret terms, how to interpret definitions and rules in the gray area. And the Torah says, Egyptian law is not precedent in Jewish law. And therefore, the Torah seems to be saying here, even if you wanted to make it like all the nations, you can't do it. The Torah is this, that. But the Mephoshim Torah, the question is right on, and the Mephoshim Torah is right there. Okay, let's continue. So the Simalecha Melech, right? Asher Yivchar, אשר לוקח הפור, מקרב אחיך, תשים עליך מלך. Okay? So it says, אשים עליך מלך, and it says, some תשים, and then again it says, תשים עליך מלך. Right? It should have said, מקרב, skip the first something, what I need the some תשים for? And what do I need some תשים עליך מלך? You just say, אשים עליך מלך, you say, hey, some תשים עליך מלך. You're going to say some to sin, which is some to sin, Kashi. What do you mean? Alecha melech. What do you mean melech again? And then it says the third time, Mikem lechecha to sin alecha melech. Right? So there's a lot, tremendous amount of redundancy here. So let's now look at the Sifri. Now the Sifri is kind of Yiddish literature. Remember when we talked about the evolution of Allah in the very first year, I pointed out that Tanaitic literature is organized in two ways. First of literature, prior to the 250th coming here. One is to organize according to the big book, that every time there is a... Okay, so the Som Tassim Alecha Melech, I'm sorry, one way to organize literature is according to the big book, which is the Chumash, and you have a pasuk, and you darshan the pasuk, and you organize the halachas based on the pasuk. The other is to do it topically, encyclopedically, and that's the mission. And now what we're going to look at is the Medrash Halacha, the Sifri, that appears on this pasuk. So it says, Som Tassim. So how do they learn Som Tassim repetition? It means do it again and again. Som Tassim, what is the same source to? Mate, Meneh Acher Tata. First king dies, or the second one. And once you started the process of kingship, some to see, do it again and again and again. The king dies, do it again. Now, it's then it says in that second part, Som to sim alecha melech, right? You already just said melech, and you say melech again. Tassim alecha melech. So what does the Medrash say here? Melech velo malka. Okay, this is where the fun begins. Now, Melech v'lo Malka, a king and not a queen. All right, so seems that from this drasha, queens are out. So queens are out. Okay, Asher yivchar Hashem lekecha bo, that God takes, al pi navi, mikirbecha v'lo mikhusa. So it has to be cast from the land of Israel. Okay, very good. Now, let's look at the next verse. It says, "Lo tuchal asim alecha." Right? It says, "Then the pasuk we're looking at pasuk second pasuk." So to sim alecha melech asher yivcha asher alecha from mikerev achecha from amongst your brothers. Then it says, "Lo tuchal asim alecha ish nachli." You can't put on a stranger. You just said mikerev achecha from amongst your brothers. What is this ish nachli? Asher lo achicha was not your brother again. Really, a lot of redundancies. So what does the Sifri say? Lo tuchal natek alecha ish nachri, zot mitzvat lo tasei, ish nachri asher lo achichu, mikan amru, from this we learn, ein memanim parnas al hatzibur, you don't appoint a leader on the community, ad shetehe imo, we saw that, because his mother is Jewish. Okay, now it means that even if his mother is a convert, he can't be king. Because you have to have yichus. Your mother, not your father. Your mother must have been born Jewish. Asher lo achichu, which is not your brother, zeha'ed. This is the demi-Jew. Okay? Now actually the drashot here, there are two exclusions here. Actually the logical order would be Asher lo achichu, the one who's a demi-Jew, actually, he himself is not Jewish, right? And then the second exclusion is one whose mother wasn't Jewish. Not that he's not Jewish, but his mother wasn't Jewish. All right, let's not go over that. That's it. Okay? Now, notice the pasuk said, so far we see that who can't be a convert? Who can't be a leader of the community? A convert, the son of a convert, whose mother is a convert, and a woman can't be queen. It doesn't say yet that she can't be the leader of the community, does it? All it says, Melech velo Malka. It doesn't say anything about Parnas. When did the first time we see the word Parnas? Parnas means leader. Okay? We saw notice that you have to be very careful with the language because it's very important. The text, the drasha said, melech v'lo malkah, king, but not a queen. And then from the word, it says, lo tuchal atet alecha ishna, you can't put upon you a strange person. Now, upon you, a strange person, the Gemara understands it, not only as a king, but for anything that's upon you. Okay? Anything that, any leadership role, and there it says that a leader, anybody who's upon you, can't be a convert, or a son of a convert. Okay? Now, we will talk about the importance of why the Gemara wants, why it's important to be Yichus. We'll see that it's not only converts, people that work in, also people who work in tanning. There's a certain amount of yichus that's involved, even if the type of employment that you have is critical, can rule you out for kingship. And there's a rationale for it, which we will discuss. There's a major problem, by the way. Who do we know who are converts, or children of converts, who led Klal Yisrael? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was considered the son of a convert. Okay, Ben Gibbon, he was known. And Shmaya Bav Talio, they were sons of converts. They were the heads of the yeshiva. They led Klal Yisrael. So you see that it's not black and white. Okay? We have two examples.
And
David. By that time, David is already. That's right. He comes from a family of converts, but by that generation, the point is that the convert or the child or his mother, whose mother is a convert, can't be a king or leader. We have to finish it. We haven't defined what type of leadership we're talking about. Is democracy there? Is a modern period? We haven't talked about any of those issues. We don't even have a rationale. We're just gathering data now, okay? Where? The pasuk, but I'm trying to explain to you, notice that the Sifri says, Ein namanim tamas ala tzibur. The Sifri has already jumped, and that's a very important jump. Until now, when it said melech v'lo malka, it didn't say Ein namanim tamneset ala tzibur. It said malka. The drasha was melech v'lo malka. When it came to say, when the Torah comes and says, you don't have the power, and there's a asher lo'achicho there, where the Torah really rules it out, so they understand alecha meaning not only kingship, but any position upon you. Okay? Then it starts talking about parnas. Okay? Now, let's continue collecting the data. Okay? Now, the next drasha, which is relevant to Shoftim. Okay, now there's a problem here, because there are 18 mitzvot to love a ger, right? Treating a ger properly, okay, with respect and love, is more important than treating a regular Jew, because there are 18 mitzvot. The deal talk about v'hafta l'tager. Okay, so the fact that the Torah here in some way seems to discriminate against the ger must have a good reason, because the Torah goes back over beyond itself to discriminate in favor of the ger, because the Torah knows that the ger needs more protection, needs more love. Okay. Now let's go on Lamed Tet. Leman yarich yamim al mamlachto. Now what does he say? If he should keep the Torah, right? What is the last pasuk? It's a very important pasuk. You should read it and say, sure, that's the last one. The Viltilum Lamo, he should keep the Torah. By the way, the Torah says he has a Torah that's with him, and there's a Torah he wears around his neck. Wherever the king goes, he's wearing around his neck the yoke of the Torah. Literally, he wears the Torah on a chain around his neck wherever he goes. But let's do that. So it says, why does he have to do this? Leman yarich yamim al mamlachto, so that he should have a long kingdom. What does that imply? That his kingdom, if he's a good king, is indeterminate. There's no limit to his kingdom. Right? Hu uvanav, he and his sons, can ask sons, daughters, but we already said Nava from a Malka, so it makes sense. Hubanav means he and his sons, literally. Hubanav, the Ked of Yisrael amongst the people of Israel, so that suggests the what? That it's inherited. The kingdom, the kingship is inherited. Okay. Okay, let me just see for 7 minutes. So, we have learned the following cannot be kings. A non-Jew, a demi-Jew, and the non-Jew is written in the text. A demi-Jew, which is an Eved, a convert, the son of a convert, and a woman. Next, that Melucha and Svara are inherited, because we saw Uvanav. And we also saw that it's of an indefinite duration, because it says, the Pasuk says, as long as he lives, it's continued. And but as we'll see in the Rambam, it's only true that his children only get it if they're worthy. That you have to be worthy of being a king. But if you're worthy, if you're a righteous individual, you get kingship automatically. Let's now read source number 3. And I apologize for the small print, but I have multiples. Okay, source number 3. אין מעמידים מלך מקהל גרים אפילו אחד אחר כמה דורות עד שתהיה אמו מישראל. His mother must be a born Jews. שנאמר לא תוכל לתת עליך איש נוכרי אשר לא אחיכלו. ולא למלכות בלבד, אלא לכל שררות של ישראל. For any position of dominion upon the people. לא לסרצבה, can't be in the army, and yet this, they can't have the position of being an officer in the army, would be לא לסרצבה, לא לסרחמישים, לא לסרצרות. אפילו ממונה על עמת המים, even one who is responsible for the riverlet of water, שמחלק ממנה לשדות, he determines, he has discretionary power to determine which water goes to, how much water goes to each field. ואין צריך לומר דיין או נשיא. Certainly can't be a judge or the prince of Israel, שלא יהיה אלא מישראל, must be a Jew. שנאמר מקרב אחיך תשים עליך מלך, כל משימות שאתה משים לא יהיה אלא מקרב אחיך, must be from the child of a born Jew. Jewess. אין מעמידים אישה במלכות, and the Rambam says, you can't appoint a woman to be a queen. Shenema alecha melech velo malka. Melech velo malka. The chain, continues the Rambam, kol mesimot shel Yisrael, ein memanim bahem elek ishev. All dominion in Israel, you can't appoint except, only can only appoint a male. Notice the Rambam has made a step that does not appear in the Sifri. The Rambam is saying, well, just as the Sifri made the leap by converts to say that not only can't they be kings, they can't have any kanas. Similarly, says the Rambam, the same thing is true for women. And in fact, if you look down at source 3b, okay, our Sifri does not have that text, right? They don't seem very happy with it.
Just
bear with me, okay? I haven't let you down yet, have I?
Never.
Okay.
The source 3.
Source 3. Okay. Some tassim alecha melech, melech velo malka. Okay, that's what the Sifri has. That's what I read to you in source number 2. Sifri sham taviyad optobitze. There's other manuscripts. And also in the Medrash HaGadol, what does it say? Ein memanim ha'isha ha'neset al ha'tzibur. There are readings of the Sifri which say not only melech velo malka, but also parneset. So the Rambam may have had a reading in the Sifri which confirmed his position. Otherwise, Moshe Feinstein doesn't say that. Moshe Feinstein holds that this was a logical leap that the Rambam made based on his analogy to Gir. But if it's a logical leap, then it need not be made, because as the Moshe Feinstein will point out, it's not necessarily so. Okay. Now, in halachas, let's read what the Rambam says halachas. Kishamamidim hamelech, when you appoint the king, noshkin oto b'shem rachshay, pour oil upon him, shenema, v'ikach shmo et hapach ha-shemet ez v'shol, v'yitzak ha-rosho v'yishakehu, ומאחר שמושלים המלך הרי זוכר לו ולבניו עד עולם. As soon as he anoints the king, he and his sons receive kingship forever. שהמלכות ירושה, because מלכות is inherited. If your father was a king and he died a king, your children, his children become kings. שנאמר למען יאריך ימים על מלאכתו, הוא ובניו בקרב ישראל. If you left a child, then you keep the, somebody takes over until he's old enough to rule for himself, and then he takes. Commotion as Yoshua. Yoash. Yoash was an infant, and when his father died, and therefore Yoyada, because it wasn't his mother Natalia. Yeah, his mother Natalia, they had her assassinated. Okay, so Yoyada arranged the coup, and he took charge of Yoash, and when Yoash became king, he took over. Old became to over. The chola kodem benachalat ben Yerusha, and he follows the rule of Yerusha. The oldest, that is, whoever is first to inherit is the first to get the kingship. Vabena gadol kodem betam ben Yerusha.
There's a certain power of
But there's nothing that seems like success. So they asked the Shaul, the Rambam said, you should be king. Of course, he also asked the Shaul. Okay.
No one mentions that she comes from Shevet Yehuda.
No. No, Shevet Yehuda comes because of Yerusha. Didn't have it enough. Yoram Levat had the kingship legitimate. Not the kingship. Not the kingship. Right? If you look through.
The Hashmonaim was usurpers because of the Kohanim,
they're not supposed to be kings.
That's correct. No, they were usurpers because you're not supposed to have Keter Malchut and Keter Malchut. Now, there weren't people from Shevet Yehuda around. There are people from Shevet Yehuda around. In the beginning, they were very careful not to call themselves kings. They called themselves Kohen Gadol, and they left it that. As they moved down and the children became more and more assimilated, they got the Hercules. They had no problems calling themselves king whatsoever. Even the Hercules in many ways was very strong. But as you got down to the kings, they keep the dash, you know. I think I used to be called the kings. And was supposed to be. Okay.
Isn't it deprecating that there couldn't be a king, but of course you said we just said that this to be new. Yeah.
We'll talk.
How many generations have to pass before you can speak in front of a Ger deprecating the about
never
going?
It's a problem. That's right. Anything that will be offensive to never. Okay, based on Now, let's see what we know. Let's see what we know so far about what Svara is. Okay, this is our next goal. We have to understand this leadership. Does it mean that you can't be head of Amuna women? Is that what Svara means? Does Svara mean that you can't be head, you know, of a shul? How? She can't be part of a committee? What is the Svara that the halacha is worried about? We saw from the Rambam that includes certain discretionary powers. The king who is the melech, the sartzava, the amat hamayim. These are sra, this is dominion. One who has discretionary powers and essentially can act as he sees fit. The people are forced to obey his decision. Now, we're going to take a break now from the sources that we've seen and now, and we're going to read some selections because I want to deal with what this Sarara means, okay? What this rule, dominion means. And we're going to read a very fascinating tshuva, source number 7, for Moshe Feinstein. We're going to read selection, we're going to read the tshuva in selections. Okay, it's this tshuva. It's actually parts of two tshuva. The Moshe Feinstein is dealing with a very interesting question. For many rabbis in America, certainly in the 50s until the modern period, okay, a great percentage of their wage was made from hashkafas. They got very little from the congregations. They may have made funerals and unveilings and weddings. They also made from hashkafas. They were a respected rabbi in the community. They got a regular shkach, that was their job, and they got a regular income from the company. Now, a particular rabbi passed away. His wife says, I know the tricks of the trade. I want to be the mashkiach. And she said, her claim was, I should get it from my husband. My husband was a mashkiach. I want that. It's my income. It's my tax. After my husband passed away, it's my own income. I'll be in charge. I know exactly what to do. I want to be in charge. And so Rav Moshe was asked this particular question. Okay, so let's now read. We see what it says, B star. That's a particular question. It says, this B, where they see there's a star. We're dealing with B star. We're now dealing with the question, okay. Vashgacha al kashrut. Mistaber shehu minun. That being, he wants to point out, Rav Moshe is arguing that being a mashkiach and kashrut, it makes sense that is a minui, that is srava, that is discretionary power. The vayal is a mikedushin da'af ayin vav, from Gemara Kedushin, she'ita ומרבה אפילו ריש קורי לא מות ממיני. ופירוש רשי ממונה על המידות. What is ריש קורי? Rashi explains, that's the one who's in charge of the weights and measures. Okay? He checks that, you know, that the kilogram is a kilogram and the liter is a liter. והוא ממש כמו השטחה לקשרות. And the Rishami says that's an example of שררה, of dominion, that's exactly like קשרות. והוא ממש כמו השטחה לקשרות. דמר לנו קשרות המשקולות. What does it make a difference? Whether your weights and measures are kosher, the קשרות ישראל מחלות, or whether your food is kosher. Essentially, you're determining whether the measure is correct, whether what's being done is correct. והתאמו, שהחילוק בין לחשיבו לפועל ובין לחשיבו לממונה, what's the difference between being subservient, subordinate, and being having dominion? What's the difference between what he calls poel, a worker, ובין הממונה, the appointed, the one who's in charge? שהוא שרבה, אינו מצד חשיבות המלאכה. It has nothing to do with the importance of the work or the lack of the importance. אלא דאם נזכר לעשות רצון, המזכירו הוא פועל, אף שהיא מלאכה חשובה. ואם נזכר לעשות נגד רצון בעל הבית, כשכחה למשקולות ומידות של הבעל הבית, הישר רוצה שיכשיר לו גם משקל ומידה חסרית. Let's go back. Let's go back to the lines of Sanhedrin. What's the difference between a poel and a worker, and one who is the boss, and the im niskar lasot ratzon hamaskiro. If the person is being hired to do what the one who hired him asked him to do, that's a worker. Hu poel af shehi melacha chashuva, even if it's an important work. The im niskar lasot negative ratzon hamaskiro, but if he's being hired even to do against the will of his boss, like. Right, the mavaker in the firm, right? The person who's hired to check the books, to be the auditor, he's hired essentially to check, not to do what his boss wants. Okay, this guy has a negative son balabayit, keshkecha ramashkolot umidot shabalabayit haya efshalom zeshya shiva. I mean, if he checks, his job is to check the weights and measures, it's possible that the owner would prefer if he let it pass by, גם משקל ומידה חסרים, even if it wasn't up to par, it was lacking something. והוא ממונה לפוסלם ולקחם מבעל הבית, and he's appointed to take him away from the owner, to the boss. הוא שררה על הבעל הבית. That's the meaning of the bala הבעל הבית. של הבעל הבית מחויב לעשות כמו שמשגיח אומר. He's obligated to do that which the supervisor, the משגיח, or the מבקר, tells him to do. וכן הוא ממש ממונה להשגיע על קשות. That's exactly what the purpose of a person who's mashkiach kashrut, shemalachto b'lasot avneged b'tzon ha'bal ha'bayit, he sometimes has to tell the bal ha'bayit, throw out the meat, or what you did, you didn't do it right, shelo b'nyeg l'bal ha'bayit shekneg d'varim asurim, that is not allowing him to buy things that are forbidden. V'im kein la'rambam ein l'manat alzei shakon l'rambam, it would seem that you could not appoint a woman to be a mashkiach kashrut, because that's the right. Now, it's very nice because we're, he's given us a sort of a first-hand and a criteria of what is dominion. If you're hired, even if it's a very important job, right? If you are the guy, the millionaire, right? Goes around and gives out $1 million, right? That's not a job of Sarah. He's always giving out $1 million. That's a wonderful job. He's only doing what his boss told him to do, right? But if his job is to take away $1 million from you, well, that's discretionary power. Okay, now let's look to 7E. This is where we're skipping a section. We'll come back to the section we skip, don't worry. In 7E, the Rambam, the Ramoshe, then says that according to the Rambam, when the Rambam says women is not allowed any discretionary powers, it should not be permissible. I should point out to you that in the intermediate, the Rambam demonstrates that other Rishonim disagree with the Rambam. The Rambam had maintained, okay, and one of the brilliance of Ramosha is how he derives it from other Rishonim. I told you that the Ramosha holds the Rambam's extension to all discussion. What does the three say? Melech v'lo malka. We saw the Rambam extended. Now there are some texts that actually say it. But we're not sure those are authoritative texts. Those may have been texts, you have to be very careful. They were emended because of the Rambam. They were emended, they saw the Rambam says it, extends it, so they amended their texts of the Sifri to be in line with the Rambam. That has not the first time things like that have had happened. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says that the Sifri, all our Tamim is the Sifri, say Melech v'lo malka. It's the Rambam who made the leap and extended to all discretionary positions. I'll demonstrate the other Rishon who disagree with the Rambam. And allow him at that discretionary position that he goes into that particular discussion. The Rambam, he says, is not the consensus opinion, necessarily. But then he says, and this again gives us insight into what discretionary power means. He says, however, Moshe Feinstein, I have a patent by which this woman can be the Mashkichat Kashrut and not violate Sarah. Let's read now 7e. And the reason why we're skipping here is because I want to give you an idea again, the insight of what the discretionary power means. I will need it. Shalamash should be outi. Okay, you with me? Which is the section E where the star is over here. Okay, this section here, this column here where the bracket begins. I will need it. Shalamash should be outi. Shazeshash gachad nakshad minui. Who bemash the abodoto who negative at some balabayit. That if his work is against the will of the Balabai, yesh itzah lekayem gam shitat haRambam. We can do it, even according to Rambam. It means, according to other Rishonim, that women can have discretionary power. His only problem is Melech v'lo malka, says Rav Moshe Feinstein. That's no problem to be Meshkifat. But even according to the Rambam, because the Rambam is one of the major pillars of Pesach, can't just leave him alone, leave him aside. He says, I work it out even according to the Rambam. Shehi tiyes churam miharav. Shirak ye ba'alim shala. What is it he say? The company hires the rab. Now you have to understand, there's two people. There's the rab ha-makshir, and there's the mashkila. Two jobs. Who's the rab ha-makshir in Rehovot? Rabbi Rubin. He's the administrative person in charge. Right? He's the one who takes in the money, he's the one who points the different mashkichim. The different mashgichim, they don't work for the Balabayit. They work for Rabbi Rubin. When they report back to Rabbi Rubin, and then Rabbi Rubin makes the administrative decision. Okay? So who has the power? There are Poalim to Rav Rubin. Rav Rubin has the discretionary power. So that's what he says. We're going to take this woman, we'll appoint the rabbi, will be the mashgiach, will be the rabbi machshir, and we'll make her the mashgiach. And she'll get paid from the Rav. That's what he says, okay? With me now? Okay, we're the fourth line here, or the end of the third line. Shehi tiyes chura me'arav, shorak arav yabalim shalav, ubalabai yisholem asachar avur ha'ashkecha l'arav, that the balabai will pay to the rabbi, she'az ein ladin srara minui, shorak tzricha l'shloshi yanosim to the rabbi. לעשות כפי שיאמר לה, איך להשגיח, או מהו דבר אסור. כי נעביר את הימפורט פארט. כי הלא עיקר האחריות שהקונים סומכים הוא על הרב, they trust the rav המכשיר, it's his responsibility, ונחשבת היא רק כעושה מלאכת הרב בדברים שיכולה לעשות, שנחשבת לגבי הרב רק פועל. She's only ever working on that. וכפועל בעלמה, שאפשר לו גם להעמיד אישה even she met. I mean, he can point the Rav HaMakshir, but of course point the woman because she's reliable, she's trustworthy. Can I, as I pointed out before, Va'at Shahad Darish Kurei Vareshi Gambuta Nemastam Shalomuk Meminayu Shu'at Shemeshanim Sfirut Me'abedin Me'ayir V'lo Mibar Yachaniyot. Okay, let's stop there. Okay, let's stop there. I don't want to go into this. Very clear that the responsibility falls upon the Rav, okay, and she's the poet. Now, I think it should be very clear to you that it's only, the first thing we learned was that Hashgacha al Kashrut is Svara, because it forces the Balabayit to do as you say, but and there's a distinction here between a poet and Svara, and dominion, But it's only considered, the thing we learned from seven, the second section is, it's only considered sirah if the administrative responsibility falls upon you. Now, the line is seems to be clear, but it's not always clear. Let's deal with a couple of questions. President of the United States, that's sirah? Think so. Okay? He's, now, what about the head of the treasury? Is that sirah? Now, you have to understand that the Secretary of the Treasury, right, is appointed by the President. Okay? The President, his job is to, but he's not elected to run the Treasury. I mean, it's very clear that he has certain people, that he appoints these people, but these people really work for themselves. Right? He has to pick someone to do the job. He picks someone to do the job. But they do the job essentially as they see fit.
They're government.
Right, they're government employees, they pay the salary. But I think it's pretty clear that the Secretary of the Treasury does the CC straight. He doesn't consult the President of the Treasury. I don't think so. What about income tax auditor? What? The treasury makes determines how much money flows and there's a major dispute that's going on now with Franco. The Rosh Hashanah tells him to do this and he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to do it. They have certain independent power. What about income tax?
If you've been meeting what's been going on with the audit statements, they've been. They were doing what the higher ups in the IRS told them to do. So it could be that the entire administration of the IRS is telling these IRS auditors who are mivakrim according to this definition, but they're really not actually polling because there are people ahead of them who told them they have to.
The question, I agree. I think that the person who's an income tax auditor is a fellow. I think it's very clear he's a fellow. His guidelines are set by people that are above him. I had some talks you can appeal, you can always appeal to somebody above them. And it's true that there's a certain problem, they interpret the law as best they understand it, but they're merely carrying out the law. I don't think that the average income tax auditor has discretionary powers. I think that there's a certain point that you get, I don't know where that line is. I don't think it's so clear. But at some certain point, work for the state, but give discretionary powers.
But in each district, the highest echelon is where the question arises.
It seems to me that where the buck stops here is where true there's discretionary power. As long as there's, you can keep appealing higher and higher, and somebody can make the decision, that's you're still a powell. The point at which you become the final word in that area, that's discretionary power. Okay. And I sometimes feel like having had to fight the bureaucracy in Masechta Pnim. There's always some place where it stopped. You could keep going higher and higher and higher and higher, and at some point it stopped. The point that it stopped, I think that's the discretionary power. Maybe because I didn't know where to push the button any higher.
It's almost like God, it's Israel, humanity.
That's because you say that person with discretionary power has to follow certain rules and he's not following the proper rules, the interpretation of his rule. But that's not that he didn't have the power to in the gray area to make that decision. What you argued is that there was no gray area. You say that that rule, that particular point that he decided upon, he misinterpreted. It wasn't discretion. He didn't have discretion. But it doesn't mean he doesn't have discretionary powers.
Well,
what I'm saying.
Any questions, Mom? See, I don't think there's any power.
You're raising a very
old time melody.
You're right. We'll come back to that. I'm trying to get a handle on what we mean by these discretionary powers. We're going to come to that. We're just going to say that this whole concept of discretionary power in Sura in the democracy is radically different. Okay. Now let's sort of deal now with the question of rationale. The question of rationale. Why is it that Melech v'lo Malka? Essentially, why is it that according to the Rambam, women can't have discretionary powers? And we have to get some insight into. Why the limitations? Now, not surprisingly, this issue didn't come up until the modern period. Nobody discusses it. Until the late 1800s, the issue wasn't even discussed. I mean, it's obvious to everyone that this leadership is men, not women. But something like the deal with the exceptions from Tzvi Malka, which Dvorah, it doesn't seem to surprise anybody. But again, it shouldn't bother you because it didn't surprise anybody in secular society either. It's only in the 1900s that things begin to change. Now, the most common reason cited, and this is mentioned by Leo Levy in an article on Jewish life, Rabbi Alice Soloveitchik, and it appears in this book, and also Meisel in his book, Jewish Women and Jewish Law, is that there is definite role playing in Jewish life. And the man's role is the more public, aggressive role. As the Gemara says, Ish Daka Lichbosh, Ein Isha Daka Lichbosh, that is, the man has the more aggressive role. We saw this in Aaron Soloveitchik's article. The Kishua was the minion, was the man's hand. A woman's role is meant to be more private, family-centered, based on the concept of Kol Kvuda but Nala Pnima. By limiting women's possibilities in leadership, and again, we don't know where those limits are. It seems to be Machlok V'Rishonim. I'm hinting to it, but the fact of it is seems to be Machlok V'Rishonim. Whether it's, she can't be king, but she can be anything else, or as the Rambam says, no, any major leadership role, Balacha perhaps reaffirmed where her priorities should be, as is often said in the home, but not in the House of Representatives. Other posting seem to say, like the Orsamech seems to say that it's only king, because kings go to war. And war is a man's job, not a woman's job. Woman's job is to put life into the world, not to take life. Yes, Torah, that the Jews have to war too. Right? She said to Barak, Noam Ben Amin, Barak Ben Amin comes to him and says, take the guys out to war. Torah says to Barak, take them out to war against Israel. And he says, I ain't going if you're not going. She says, but there I'm going to stay. A woman let you out the battle. So what am I saying? She says, I ain't going without you. So he went with her. So she led him to battle. I mean, she was there. She was an inspiration. She was the Jewish Hamdan. Anyway, another formulation may have to do with the social reality. And perhaps this gives a little different an understanding into several other halachot. I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to understand is the problem of the ger. But you'll see there's something even more complicated than the ger. The chinuch in source 4, and it actually appears in the Rambam. Take a look at what the chinuch says in source 4. On the first page. Midini ha-mitzvah, ma-shamu zechonam lebacha, she'im ha-midim ala mezer Yisrael, rosh Yisrael, you only pick from Jewish stock. Okay, to be head of Sarah, but filu mumuna lamata, even the one with discretionary powers, how to distribute the water, shmechalek mimel of the sadot. Va'amu gamke, they also say, she'in mamidim melech velo kohen gadol, you can't appoint a king nor a kohen gadol. Right? Remember, you can have a kohen gadol, listen, you can have a kohen gadol Is it possible? No, it's not possible. She says, it's not possible. Okay. Ein mamidin melech v'lo pen gadol, l'mishu sapar o balan, a barber, one who served as a barber, o balan, one who served in the Beit HaMerchatz, was in charge of the mikvah, worked in the mikvah, you know. O busi, ma'abed o'ra, one who worked in a tanner, which was a smelly business. Lopet meshiu psulim l'achol, not because they are pasul the malchus inherently that they pass on to their children, al meshi amunatanik umanutanik, because their job is considered a lowly job. I guess you would say garbage collector, would they fall and say, collect a job, even though it's nothing, it's nothing unrespectful, disrespectful of what he's doing. Mezalfin b'hem ha'om le'olam. People treat them lightly. Umish yasem b'lachot elu afilu yom echad, if he works in such jobs, even one day, nisal b'slot elu, can't be his job. The people says, I want to listen to you. You were a garbage collector. I want to listen to you. You're going to tell me how to run the city. The garbage collector. The guy who washed my back in the bathhouse. He took care of my towel. He was a stinky. He worked in, you know, like in San Francisco, who worked in the refit. I mean, I don't know what is included, but it says a tanner or something like that. Leadership is not only a question of your personal yichus, it has to do with what the people are willing to follow, what the people are willing to show respect for. And if you have an occupation, says the Chinuch, which is not considered a respectable occupation, you cannot have a leadership role. Yes?
No, it's just not, I don't know, it's like any Chinuch. Whatever job you have, and at least you're getting money and you're supporting your family.
I think you're speaking idealistically. I think the Chinuch is speaking realistically. That there is a certain person, if you have a certain, let's put it, skeletons in the closet, a person who, what? We don't, I think it was 1400s.
Many presidents who had very old jobs before they were very humble.
That's right.
It's considered what?
Different idea.
I think so. Look, and the Aruch HaShulchan says as follows: She'atamim uvuarim ditzchim l'ro'ot shelamelech yeh kakavod hayotar gadol. There has to be a certain respect for the king. Now, I would say Harry Truman could make it because of the American ethic of hard work and the more you come from, the better it is. It wasn't true in England. I'm sorry. It certainly was not true in England that if you didn't come from the right lineage that you could get any distinguished position.
You're not
very exceptional. It was clear that leadership was given to the nobility. And you're not even talking about nobility, you're talking about people whose job was lonely. So it seems that, I will tell you, even like you can put it all you want to, the fact of the matter is that all the statistics demonstrate that women and men will generally vote for a strong father image than over an iron lady. And all the statistics have demonstrated that men and women will vote for a man over voting for a woman of equal capabilities. And you can argue from Heinten to Morgan, then it's the facts. So, and I don't think it's justifying it, I'm telling you, the Chinuch seems to be reflecting, or the Halacha seems to be reflecting, that there's got to be a certain element of charismatic leadership. It's not enough to come from good stock, but there has to be a certain amount of charismatic leadership. And if there's some lowly profession or if there's some pagam in your yichus, the people won't follow.
But Hashem chose Moshe Rabbeinu when he was taking care of
the sheep. Even though you're in the house of the king, you come from good stock, I also want you to have some wonderful traits. But that doesn't mean that the people would have followed him if he wasn't from good stock. Is that clear? People want to look up to the leaders. But I want to know something. Do you think that Diana would have been Diana if she wasn't? Good stuff.
She didn't marry good stuff.
She had a marriage.
I better change the analogy. Now, I should point out that Chaim David HaLevi is the opinion of Beit HaShlomo Tzion HaMalka that a woman can be queen. He proves from Shlomo Tzion HaMalka that a woman can inherit kingship. Right? She can't be appointed,
but she can.
She can inherit. So he says there's nothing wrong with a woman being queen. It's something about wrong with being appointed queen. That's his argument. He says the whole thing is a zebat katuf. I don't understand. Essentially, it's a kabat, but we have other examples like it. So,
Can he do a commodate and there should be a
government? Of course. Of course. Well, I don't know. That's an interesting question because that means it should be. Whether how does he say about making other appointments? He seems to hold that women just can't be appointed queens. I think he does.
Prime Minister, yes.
What?
Prime Minister, yes.
Prime Minister, what happened?
Margaret Thatcher.
She does the shark. Okay. Anyway, look, we'll continue next week. I want to point out that, see, I'm totally honest with you. I don't have a good reason. Why the Torah? I think, as in many other cases, there is a combination of two. I think that the Torah was in some extent attempting to indicate that the Torah wanted to limit a woman's leadership roles, capabilities, in a srara mode. But as we're going to see, just one second, as we're going to see next week, democracy is a total different situation. That the halakha, essentially, as written on the books, is meant for appointments, for kingship, stuff that comes from the doctor, jobs that are hereditary. Democracy, by its very nature, is a totally different, totally different. It's limited in duration, the power comes from below, not from above. Okay? It's that people accept upon themselves. And we're going to begin again with our analysis of Dvorah and how she became queen, how she became leader, and we'll get an analysis about it. Well, yeah, you can, yes. We're going to use it.
Yeah, they bring it.
Okay, see you next week.